We've been studying the life of Joseph, and Joseph, of course, was mistreated by his brothers, sold into slavery, lied about, thrown into prison, and has stayed in prison. In fact, he had a grand opportunity to be released from prison because two guys who were very close to the Pharaoh were in prison, and he interpreted their dreams to them. One of them came out to be Pharaoh's right-hand man again, and he promised Joseph that he would talk with Pharaoh about him, but, of course, the knothead forgot. And so we began this passage by saying, and so when two full years had passed, two more years in prison, Pharaoh had a dream. He was standing by the Nile River, and when out of the river there came up seven cows, sleek and fat, and they grazed among the reeds. After them, seven other cows, ugly and gaunt, came up out of the Nile and stood beside them on the river bank. And the cows that were ugly and gaunt ate up the fat, sleek cows. Then Pharaoh woke up. It bothered him. He fell asleep again and had a second dream. And seven heads of grain, healthy and good, were growing on a single stalk. After them, seven other heads of grain sprouted, thin and scorched by the east wind. The thin heads of grain swallowed up the seven healthy full heads. And then Pharaoh woke up. It had been a dream, and in the morning his mind was troubled. So he sent for all the magicians and the wise men of Egypt. Pharaoh told them his dream, but no one could interpret it for him. Then the chief cupbearer said to the Pharaoh, "Today I am reminded of my shortcomings. Pharaoh was once angry with his servant, and he imprisoned me and the chief baker in the house of the captain of the guard, and each of us had a dream the same night. Each dream had a meaning of its own. And a young Hebrew was there with us, a servant of the captain of the guard. We told him our dreams, and he interpreted them for us, giving each man the interpretation of his dream, and the things turned out exactly as he interpreted them for us. I was restored to my position. The other man was hanged." So Pharaoh sent for Joseph, and he was quickly brought from the dungeon. When he had shaved and changed clothes, he came before Pharaoh. And Pharaoh said to Joseph, "I had a dream, and no one can interpret it, but I've heard it said of you that when you hear a dream, you can interpret it." And Joseph said, "I cannot do it. But God will give Pharaoh the answer he desires." One of my old buddies used to jokingly ask, "What were you going to be if you had ever grown up?" Well, the truth is that we're all in the process of growing up. We're all in the process of becoming. Life is never static. You don't stay still. It's dynamic. You're either growing or you're regressing. You're either becoming stronger or you're becoming weaker, but you are becoming. On the other hand, we have to be careful not to fall into the trap of forgetting today while we're wishing for tomorrow. Today is crucial. It's impossible to become something tomorrow if you're not in process of becoming that today. Anytime you see today as insignificant, you can be sure that it's going to be a regressive day. In fact, if you do not see today as critical to your growth, you'll find that today's temptation is almost impossible to resist. You have situations where you say, "Today doesn't count." For whatever reason, today is an off day, and it's a regressive day. And whatever temptation comes during that time, you just have terrible, terrible time with it because the day is not important. God never looks at any of our days as unimportant. Proverbs 13:12 says, extended waiting makes the heart sick. We tend to have expectations of what is going to happen, or certainly what should happen, and when it doesn't, especially over a long period of time, we become disappointed. And if it continues, we become depressed. And our strength leaves us, our energy leaves us, and we are what Proverbs calls sick at heart. We start to feel helpless, and that moves into hopelessness, and that's just about as bad as you can feel. We're right on the rock bottom. How do you solve the dilemma when you are hoping, expecting, thinking that certain things should and ought to happen, and they don't? Well, the more basic question is, where did those expectations come from? Why do you think they should happen? What or whom are you trusting that these things are going to happen? Now, most Christians would readily say, I'm trusting in the Lord. Good. Then, are you trusting Him to do what you want Him to do in the way that you want Him to do it? Are you trusting Him to do what He wants in the way that He wants to do it? There's a huge difference there. You see, we can ask God for anything in the world. We should expect Him to give what He's promised. He's never promised to give us everything in the whole world, anything that we want. He's never said that. He said, ask. But He has a plan and a purpose, and it's very meaningful. And love always gives you what is best for you, not what you want. If you gave your children exactly what they wanted, they'd be a mess. And so, in wisdom and love, you try to give them what is best for them, whether they like it or not. Love always does what is best. Now, if you start praying and asking God for what He wants in His way, it'll be the best, but it'll sure screw up a lot of your prayers. All these prayers that you've been praying, they won't be any good anymore. What it will do, though, is it will take away most of your discouragement, because you're asking God for things to be done your way, in your time, according to your wisdom, and He's not going along with it, and you're being discouraged about it. Now, God illustrates the right approach to these things in the life of Joseph. And one of the things that we find out looking at the life of Joseph, and that is, God knows when we're ready. He knows the timing of our lives. And as we begin reading this passage, we suddenly see that Joseph has been in prison, and then because of some yo-yo forgetting, 2 years are added to his prison term. Well, now, is that the real reason that 2 years were added? 2 years were added because God was not ready. Joseph was not ready. At the age of 30, Joseph had spent nearly half of his life either as a slave or in prison. And these were the prime years of his life. Beginning with age 17, right to age 30, he is either a slave or in prison. But God has very wisely, very graciously planned and used every one of these days. And in doing so, He's brought this young man to an unusual level of maturity, both spiritually and emotionally. God has designed to use this young man in an unusual way. In order to do that, it has to take some unusual preparation, far beyond what a 30-year-old young man should be able to do. Now, the Bible doesn't give us a lot of detail about what Joseph thinks, all the process that he goes through in dealing with his confinement, with his pain, with the false accusations that are made against him, with the waiting process. We're not told all the details about it. But there are several things that are real clear. One of them is, during this time, he refused to cling to anger. When people lie about us, when people stab us in the back, when people do things against us to hurt us, and in fact we are hurt, it's natural to feel angry. Anytime we experience loss or pain, anger is a very natural thing. But the temptation that we have is to cling to the anger. To hold on to it. I deserve to feel angry, and that person doesn't deserve to be forgiven. And so then we begin to feel sorry for ourselves, and we start blaming people. We can even feel very righteous about our anger. But if we hold on to it very long, the anger becomes sin. And the sin becomes bitterness. And the bitterness starts to eat away at our lives. Now we know that Joseph forgave and put these things behind him. We're not told a lot of details about it, but what we do know is this. The scripture is very honest about the saints. If they've got warts and moles, it tells it. If they've got rotten attitudes, it tells it. If they feel sorry for themselves, it tells it. And it doesn't tell that Joseph had a rotten attitude, so we know that his attitude was good, or God would have said it. But not only that, when he later had opportunity to express blame and to retaliate, he did not. When very shortly he came into position of power, he was powerful enough to do anything he wanted to. And he never called anybody on the carpet, and he never retaliated. So we know that he resolved those issues, because otherwise they would have come out. The second thing that he did was he was very confident about God working in his life during those hard, hard days. He knew that God considered the days of his life to be very significant and very purposeful. Now again, he doesn't tell us details about that, but what we do find is when he's brought before Pharaoh, and Pharaoh says, "I want you to interpret this dream," he says, "I can't do it, but God will." How did he know God would do it? The only way he knows what God's going to do is what God has been doing. See, God has been working in his life on a daily basis throughout all of this misery. God has been faithfully working, and he knew it. And since he knew God had been working yesterday and the day before, he knew God was going to work today too. See, that's the way we get to know God. Not by guessing what he's going to do or looking through the Bible and sticking your finger on a verse and hoping that it's going to tell you something magical. No. If God's working in your life today, he's going to be there tomorrow. And Joseph knew it. A third thing about Joseph during this situation, and that is, in every situation he found himself, he served. He was very faithful. He was very diligent to the point that everyone who was in authority over him knew that he could be trusted. They all had total and complete confidence in him. He becomes a slave. He is bought as a slave into Potiphar's house. And before very long, Potiphar has turned over everything he owns to this young slave and says, "I'm not even going to look over your shoulder. You will do what's right." How did he know? Because he did it. See, there's character and consistency that shows forth in this young man's life that says, "I can trust you." He is thrown in prison, and before long, the warden has turned the entire prison over him to run. How could he do this? There is confidence in this man, and the reason is because the young man has a view of authority. If you are under authority and you have a very good view of authority that you're under, then you're going to have a very good ability to use authority. If you have a poor attitude toward authority, God is never going to give you a responsibility of authority because you're not going to handle it. See, the attitude of authority is very important. And it demonstrates itself that when he did have authority, those who were under him were treated graciously. He served them rather than kicking them around. Joseph's life is God's answer, an answer to Rudyard Kipling's challenging poem, If. Listen to Joseph's life as you read this. If you can keep your head when all about you are losing theirs and blaming it on you, if you can trust yourself when all men doubt you, but make allowance for their doubting too, if you can wait and not be tired of waiting, or being lied about, don't deal in lies, or being hated, don't give way to hating. Sound like Joseph? Sounds like some of us too. And don't look too good or talk too wise. That's a lot harder to do when we can throw in a few things. If you can dream and not make your dreams your master, if you can think and not make thoughts your aim, if you can meet with triumph and disaster and treat these two impostors just the same, if you can bear to hear the truth you've spoken twisted by knaves to make a trap for fools, or watch the things you gave your life to broken and stoop and build them up with worn out tools, if you can make one heap of all your winnings and risk it in one turn of pitch or toss and lose and start again at your beginnings and never breathe a word about your loss, if you can force your heart and your nerve and sinew to serve you, serve your turn long after they're gone, and so hold on when there's nothing in you except the will which says to them, hold on. If you can talk with crowds and keep your virtue, or walk with kings, or lose the common touch, if neither foes nor loving friends can hurt you, if all men count with you, but none too much, if you can fill the unforgiving minute with 60 seconds worth of distance run, yours is the earth and everything that's in it, and which is more, you'll be a man, my son. Joseph learned how to wait. He learned how to be lied about. He learned how to be hated and how to be hurt, and yet he kept his eyes on God instead of on people. And that's the difference. And through this process, God did much more than make a man out of him. He made a man of God out of him. See, godliness doesn't just happen. You don't pray to be godly. It happens because God is working in your life in all the hard situations. And you keep your eye on Him. And that's what took place in this young man's life. Now God is able. The wonderful thing about Him being powerful is He is able to do what He wants to for us. And when He wants to do good things for us, He can change and move anything and anybody that He needs to bring that about. And frequently, He uses the natural weaknesses and tendencies of people. People who don't even know they're serving God, He's using them to do whatever He wants to do in our behalf, if that's what He's trying to do. In this case, He uses Pharaoh's fear. Fear is a very easy thing to use because everybody's got it. Fear has its good part and its bad part. Throughout the Bible, God tells over and over, don't fear. Don't be anxious. Trust me. Now, fear is a very normal, God-given reaction. The occurrence of fear is not sin. It is a natural reaction to danger. It's an effective alarm that moves us to action and to safety. But it's such a powerful emotion that if we hang on to it, if we stay under its grip very long, it will eat away at us and it'll start to distort our lives and entrench patterns in our lives that we don't want. Fear can destroy us. Fear is very real. There are very legitimate reasons to be fearful. Insecurity brings fear. everyone is insecure. Ever since Adam, we have all been totally insecure. And so we have reason to be fearful. Actually, there's only one reason that we have not to be fearful. And that one reason is a well-informed trust in God. There's only one person who is secure and that can make secure, and that is God. And if you understand who He is and why He is so trustworthy, then if you trust Him, He can give you security. But it's important that you know who He is and why He's trustworthy. Otherwise, you may be trusting in the God of your imaginations or the God of your wishes. And the God of your wishes and imagination can give you nothing. It's only the true God who gives you security and can release you from fear. Now, the good thing about fear is this. It gets the ball rolling. If God wants to get things moving, fear can get it going. And that's what happened with Pharaoh. He gave Pharaoh two dreams that just shook him right down to his toenails. And he was afraid, and something happened. It's important for us to understand something about the nature of dreams. Dreams should never be seen as special revelation. Ah, I dreamed this. God is speaking to me. No, no. Research tells us that every one of us dreams several times each night. Our dreams often seem long and involved, but they usually last about 30 seconds. And then they fade quickly, and most of them we don't even remember. But dreams are not some mysterious revelation by God in which He's teaching us truth. Dreams are when our minds are working subconsciously and are sorting through the feelings about the issues and events of the previous day. Sometimes our minds reach back to some unresolved issue in the past and bring them forward, and you're still trying to work through and resolve these unresolved issues in your life. Dreams usually come as some sort of a drama in which our feelings are played out in some kind of animated way. So what do you do with your dreams? Well, if you have dreams, what it's telling you is something is unresolved. You're struggling with something that you haven't done the right thing with. Either you haven't forgiven somebody, or there's something that you're frightened about that you don't know what to do about. There's something you're not trusting the Lord about. There's something you haven't thought through. There's an issue that's impending that you need to do something about. Whatever it is, there's something that you would do well to say to yourself, what in the world is it that I need to deal with? I've got to be responsible about this. And then bring God into it and say, Lord, give me wisdom to see and understand what's going on in my life. What is it that I'm dealing with on the inside that I need to bring to the surface and work on? And give me wisdom and the grace to do it. That's the right thing to do. In Pharaoh's case, however, God really was giving special revelation. In Pharaoh's case, there was a supernatural message which was intended to rattle his cage. God wanted to shake him up and bring Joseph out of prison, and so he gave him two dreams. And they did shake him up. The bad thing about fear is, fear focuses on the worst possibilities. What fear does is it looks at the situation, decides what the very worst possibilities are, and considers them to be true. And so you're afraid of something that's not real. Pharaoh's dream began normally enough. It was the typical Egyptian summer day. Cattle were coming up out of the river. I mean, if you were a cow and there was a nice river there on a hot day, wouldn't you get in it? Well, they do. And so they're coming up out of the river, and he sees these magnificent animals that are just so healthy and sleek and fat and just wonderful. But you know what? He does not focus on them. He looks at them, he mentions them, but then after them comes out these scrawny, awful looking. As a matter of fact, he stops and he says, you know, I've never seen any cattle in Egypt that are this ugly. And he goes on and on about how ugly these cows are, and they must be from somewhere else because Egypt simply doesn't grow cows this ugly. But they come up, and of course they eat the big, fat, sleek, healthy cows. Now this is somewhat upsetting. And so he's going to find out from the wise men what all this means when along comes the next dream of the 7 ears of grain that are just wonderful, just so healthy on the stalk. And then right below them on the same stalk comes up 7 shriveled up grains, stinking grain. And they have been blasted and beaten by the eastern wind, and he knows what this means. He knows that when there's no rain and there's no water and the wind from the desert comes in and beats on those things and shrivels them up, it means bad, bad news. There's going to be nothing to eat and everybody's going to go hungry. Egypt was 96% desert. As a matter of fact, up until 1970, when the Aswan Dam was completed, Egypt has been 96% desert. They're doing better now with the dam. But they knew what drought meant, and they knew what famine meant. In fact, one ancient inscription has a prayer from one of the pharaohs to one of his gods, and he says this: "My heart is in great anxiety on account of misfortune, for in my time the Nile has not overflowed for a period of 7 years. That was his 7 years of drought. There is scarcely any produce in the field. Herbage fails. Stables are wanting. Every man robs his neighbor. The children cry. The young people creep along. The aged heart is bowed down. Their limbs are crippled. The people of the court are at their wit's end. The storehouses were built, but all that was in them has been consumed." He knew what he was afraid of, and his fears were well justified, because the worst famine that Egypt had ever had was on its way, and he could see it. He had even more of a reason to be afraid, though, and that is because he had no way of understanding the gracious provision of God. See, God was making a gracious provision and was telling him about it. He didn't know God, he didn't know how to understand God, and he didn't know anybody that knew God. So he had a good reason to be fearful. He lived in a land that worshipped 2,000 deities. And these 2,000 deities all were part of a great lie, because there are not 2,000 deities. There's only one deity, and all the rest are fake. And the one deity was somebody he did not know. The intensity of his fear was very important, though, because it at least moved him to action, and that's what God wanted. There was every reason not to be afraid, but he didn't know that reason. The reason not to be afraid is that God is in control. The reason not to be afraid was God was making provision. And his provision included the fact that Joseph was there at hand, and Joseph was ready. God had prepared Joseph. And included in that also was the fact that the cupbearer was suddenly about to have a brilliant restoration of memory. He was going to remember about Joseph. So Joseph was called in from the prison. He couldn't get his wise men and his magicians to tell him anything. This sounds like Daniel's situation, doesn't it? So all the wise men come in. They don't know anything. They're not very wise. So he brings in Joseph from prison, and Joseph explains what this thing means. He says, listen, both of these dreams are the same thing. The reason God's given you 2 dreams is because he wants you to know it's important and it's coming quick. The second thing you need to know is that the fat cows and the healthy grain mean 7 years of wonderful, wonderful crops. You are going to have bounty coming out of your ears for 7 you are going to have bounty coming out of your ears for 7 years, and then you're going to have 7 years that are so bad that you're going to forget what anything tastes like. You will forget that you ever had plenty when these 7 years hit. So the 7 best years you've ever seen, followed by the 7 worst years you've ever seen. And then he did something that made everybody in the court stand back, because nobody told Pharaoh what to do. He said, tell me what this means. They tell him what it means, they think. Then he said, now, here's how you handle this. You handle this in this way. During the 7 years of plenty, 20% of everything that is grown, you take as tax, you put it in the granaries, you store it up, you keep it, and when the 7 bad years come, it's going to be plenty to feed everybody, and you just need somebody that knows what they're doing to run this thing. If you do it, you'll be okay. Well, he's blown away. To begin with, you can't believe anybody understands this and can give it in such simple, straightforward terms that are doable. And so he said, where am I going to get somebody that's bright enough to do this? Well, everybody around standing around him is a dummy, except one guy. And so he says, you made it. You're appointed. So immediately, Joseph becomes a very, very powerful leader. Joseph immediately becomes second only to the Pharaoh. Pharaoh says to him, you will be second only to me in terms of the throne. Whatever you say, people will do, and they will not lift a hand or a foot unless you say so. That's absolute authority, right? You can do anything you want to, and people will do whatever you say. What's more, it's all symbolized by the fact that you will have your own chariot, and there'll be people running along in front of you saying, everybody get out of the way, Joseph's coming. That's a lot of prestige, a lot of power. Leadership is not all fun and games. You know, we'd kind of all like to be the leader. I'd like to all be the boss. We'd like to all... Now, you who run your own business know that being the boss doesn't mean that you sit around. The boss is the guy who works the long hours. Okay? The boss is the one who has the headache. The boss is the one who deals with all the stuff. So Joseph had to find out that leadership was not all fun and games. And the first thing that he found out, of course, was that he had to have the right preparation, which God had in fact given him. He immediately realized why God had to get him ready, because with lightning speed, he moved from the depths of the dungeon to the steps of the throne. Just like that, he was moved from a prisoner and a slave to the most powerful man in the world. How could he get ready that quick? He couldn't. He had to get ready before that happened. So if God is going to use you, he's going to get you ready beforehand, not after you found out what wonderful things you're going to do. The only thing, they had him run from the prison to the throne, and he paused long enough to shower, shave, and put on some white clothes. Okay? The important changes took place on the inside, and they took 13 years. You can't run from the prison to the throne without any preparation. You can stand before men in positions of leadership just by having on the right clothes. You cannot stand before men and exercise leadership unless you've got a right heart. See, but that takes longer. You're not talking about a shower and a shave and a change of clothes. Joseph stood before Pharaoh, and the things that he said to Pharaoh came out of his relationship to God. He did not know what he was going to say before Pharaoh. It wasn't planned. It came right out of his relationship to God. And so in addition to having the right preparation, he had to have the right strategy. And the right strategy came out of a relationship. The Pharaoh said, I want you to tell me. And he said, I can't, God can. See, what he did was he exalted the wisdom of God. He knew that what he was going to tell Pharaoh was going to be right, and it was going to have a tremendous impact. And so he wanted to get it real clear who was the slave and who was the sovereign. He knew he was going to take a position of power, and he knew he had to stay in the servant role, and the sovereign power had to remain God. And when that was real clear with him, it had to be clear with Pharaoh. Now, Pharaoh didn't know what that meant. He didn't know anything about humility and power going together. But Joseph did, and that had to be established. The second thing was he exemplified the wisdom of God in his own life. He told Pharaoh not only what needed to be done, but how to do it. Information is not of a great deal of help unless it's useful. Doesn't matter how true it is. If it's not usable, it's not going to help you much. That's the difference between knowledge and wisdom. You can read your Bible for knowledge. The scripture says, when you get knowledge, get wisdom. You can get knowledge with your brain. You got to get wisdom with a heart that's sensitive to God. Very important. You know, being in a church where you can study the Bible and learn the Bible, that's wonderful. It just may make you fat-headed and proud. When you get knowledge, get wisdom. How do you turn it into godly living? That's what's important. And Joseph did that. He demonstrated that he had a very specific workable plan that God could use through him. Pharaoh was in such awe of the simplicity of the truth that Joseph was a shoe-in for the job. And the other thing about leadership is that you got to have the right stuff. How does a young man who has been a slave ever since he was 17 suddenly become the most powerful man in the world and handle it? How do you suddenly handle power and prestige and wealth? Most of us can't do it, and that's the reason God doesn't give it to us. Unless God has prepared you for it, you will not be able to do it. Again, we don't have a lot of details about Joseph, but we do have some specific things that we know that give us a little insight. First of all, as I mentioned before, when Joseph came to power, he never retaliated against those who had treated him like dirt. One of the reasons that we know this is his first son, who was born, was named Manasseh, and Manasseh means causing to forget. And he said, I'm naming him Manasseh because God has caused me to forget all about everybody that's treated me like dirt. That's pretty good. Now, he was able to let the junk go. He was able to forgive and get it out of the way, so his life has something valuable to it. The second son that was born, name was Fruitful. Ephraim means fruitful, and it was because God had blessed him, and he knew the blessings came from God. See, when you know where the good things come from, you have a thankful heart. And when you got a thankful heart, you're way ahead. A third thing was that he was gracious to people. When he was in authority, and by the way, when you got authority, when you're in leadership, everything that goes wrong, you get blamed. Count on it. You get blamed. I don't care whose fault it is. You get blamed. But Joseph, when the things got tough, didn't get a lot of grief. It meant he had to be extremely wise, extremely gracious, but the other thing that was working for him is he never quit being a servant. Everything that he did, here's a guy who can do anything he wants to. He gets up early, he goes to bed late, and he's working himself right into the ground because he's trying to help them. And when he gets through, he's helped them. He's kept them from starving to death. So because they have hardship, they don't have to deal with him. So you got to learn to handle power, prestige, and wealth. The other thing is you got to learn to make some really tough decisions. And believe me, all decisions aren't great ones. A lot of them are very tough, and a lot of them go against the grain of everything. There were three areas in which he had to make decisions. One was during the time of prosperity. One was during the time in which there was famine. And one was after the famine. Now, during the time of prosperity, 7 years in which everybody was happy and everybody was rich and everything was going good, there was a tremendous amount of work, but the decisions were easy. All he had to do was go out and gather 20% of all the goods, find places to store it, build the silos, build whatever it is, store the stuff, put it strategically placed so that when people needed it, they'd be able to get it. No problem. And nobody was griping about it. Nobody minded giving 20% because, remember, 20% was going to be enough for everybody to live on and then serve and then sell to all the nations around who were hungry. 20% was going to be enough. And they had 80% to live on. 20% went in the coffers, 80% they had. Everybody was happy. Joseph, it says, it was so much Joseph, he quit keeping record of how much was there. It was that much. Then, during the time of famine, he opens up the storehouse and begins to sell the grain, all at a good price. They use up all their money, and then they say, we're still hungry, what are we going to do now? So they then sold the livestock, which was smart, because the livestock were eating up the grain. And then they ran out of livestock and the food, and so then all they had was their land and then themselves. So they sold their land to Pharaoh and then themselves in servitude. And they lasted through the 7 years. And then Joseph said, okay, now we got to manage this after the famine's over. And so he said, okay, here's your land back. You work it for Pharaoh. You keep 80% of everything that's there. And 20% goes to Pharaoh. He gives them everything back to them that they had, and they're to work it. They get to keep 80%. That's better than most of us do with our tax system. You know? So they didn't have it too bad. In fact, they were allowed to prosper because it was percentage. If they doubled their output, they doubled what they kept. Okay? So it's not a bad deal. But as difficult as it was, and the whole idea of losing your stuff and your freedom and the whole thing, they said to Joseph with great applause, you've saved our lives. Now, for most of us, because we live in a society where there's democracy and freedom and so forth, this whole idea that you should have to sell your land and your property and your all of your money and even go into servitude yourself, that's unthinkable. And we would say, now, if Joseph is running a ship like that, he's not a very loving guy. I mean, he's not. He should be more gracious than that. I mean, after all, it was their stuff that he gathered, and he should give it back to them, and if he had given it back to them, everything would have been fine. If he had given it back to them, they'd have starved to death. They didn't do well on 80%. How do you think they'd have done on 20%? He said, that's big government running people's lives. Actually, it's a graphic example of total irresponsibility reaping the harvest of its folly. It's people being bailed out the only way that they can ever survive, because if he hadn't bailed them out in that way, they would all starve to death. And at least they were bright enough when it was all over to realize that if he hadn't done it, they would have starved to death. When you begin to see this kind of an emotional issue and you begin to identify yourself with it, a lot of questions come up. And that's good, because I want us to think about a couple of principles that come out of this that we can look at. The first principle is this. We never have enough surplus to waste. Never. That's time, that's money, that's energy. We never have surplus to waste. You remember when Joseph was in prison? He had surplus. He had more time than you could ever want. He didn't want 13 years worth of time. That was surplus to do nothing with. Not only that, but he had surplus in personal resources. What do you do when you're a prisoner? Nothing. All the creativity, all the resources, all the strength, all the energy was total surplus. Not only that, but he had the surplus of anything that he could earn the responsibility of doing. Now, if Joseph had misused and thrown away any of those things, If he had not used his time wisely, if he had not used his personal resources wisely, if he had not used the opportunity and responsibilities that he earned wisely, Joseph would have died a miserable, pitiful, poor guy that we would say, poor, poor guy, what a sis. He was so mistreated, and he would, oh, it should never happen to anybody, and he would have died nothing. Because he squandered his surplus. Now we're not talking about a rich man, but he had surplus, and he used every bit of it. And the result was God was able to do something fantastic with him. The Egyptians, on the other hand, had 7 years of plenty. It was coming out their ears. 20% fed everybody and everybody around them, and they gave 20%. If they had lived on 20% themselves, they would have had 60% to save and invest and store and whatever. And they squandered it. Total self-indulgence. Total lack of discipline. Total lack of responsibility. Nothing to show for it. No savings. No investment. And they knew that the famine was coming. This was being forewarned. Foresight and wisdom are not something that just naturally fits into our being. We don't use it. Foresight and wisdom come only when we trust God. See, this young guy was the only one that believed God. You said, it's going to happen this way, I believe you, and I'm going to act on your wisdom, I'm going to trust you. The rest of them said, oh yeah, 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 oh yeah, yeah. And they starved to death. John Wesley's famous exhortation to believers is this: earn all you can, save all you can, give all you can. Pretty short and sweet, but that's it. After these few years on the earth, some believers are going to feast and some are going to fast. It depends on how we invest here. Unfortunately, we're told we use a very small percentage of our brain power. I forget what the percentage is. Some of you know it. What a small percent we use. That's true of all of our potential. We don't use a small percent of our creativity, a small percent of our time, a small percent of our energy, a small percent of everything that we have, we use in an appropriate way. This society has never seen the effectiveness of a person who's totally dedicated to God. You totally dedicate yourself to the Lord and you won't have any competition. There's not anybody out there fighting you for the opportunities that God will give you. The second principle is we will reap what we sow. Joseph invested his time, his energy, faithfully serving, even in the very hard times, and God exalted him at exactly the right time. When God had Joseph ready, God exalted him and gave him tremendous blessings and benefits and impact on others. The Egyptians sowed nothing and woke up and found themselves with nothing. And you and I are still in process. I don't know how we're going to come out. I don't know how we're going to sow. I don't know how we're going to reap. Some of us have relative abundance. Some of us are in tough times. But all of us are responsible to use whatever it is we've been given. Energy, time, strength, creativity, brain power, resources, whatever. None of us are in as bad a shape as Joseph was in. And he used his real well. So we can't say we don't have enough to work with. No, we got enough to work with. The third thing is, even when we're foolish, God is still gracious to us. Joseph did not do everything right. God looked at his heart and used him tremendously.
The Egyptians did not do everything right. And as a matter of fact, they set out on a course of starvation. And God graciously brought Joseph into their situation and saved them in spite of themselves. In fact, he gave them tremendous potential. 80% of everything that you do, you can keep. That's ahead of most of us. So their potential was great, in spite of the fact that they had been totally irresponsible. For us as God's children, He faithfully disciplines us. He will not allow us to go too far in the tulip before He grabs us by the nape of the neck, brings us back, turns us over our knees, over His knee, and spanks us good. He will do whatever is necessary to cause us to be fruitful. He's loving in that way. And we never lose our inheritance. He never says, sorry, you've just used up your last meal ticket, out of here you go. What He does is He takes our stupid mistakes, and He brings us, and He disciplines us, and then He teaches us. And we always learn more out of our mistakes than we do, and our sins, than we do out of our good things. God is so gracious to us. And if you serve Him, and if you have a servant's heart, He'll exalt you. He'll bring fruitfulness. He'll bless you. The last words that Joseph's dad said then was in a prophetic tone. He said, Joseph is a fruitful bough that hangs over the wall. I'd like to have enough fruit in your life. It just hangs over the wall and everybody else can get something. That's what He's really like to do with us. There are people outside the wall that are starving to death. And we can be fruitful in their life.